And that's just fun. That was fun around these days. Mr. Boker, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May I please this honorable court? I do in fact represent Clarence Mock, who is the special administrator of the estate of Carl Landgraf. And I am here today to ask this court to reverse the finding of the Otto County District Court that certain disputed instruments, namely six deeds conveying nearly 1,000 acres of Otto County farmland to the defendant, Gail Neumeister, were not the result of undue influence. We believe that this court will review this matter de novo. It is an equitable matter because it involves inter vivos transactions. Respect the de novo review obligates this court to look anew at both matters of law and of fact.
We can, however, consider the facts of the trial court and view the facts in a particular way.
So Justice Castle, Justice Castle, indeed you can, you may. And in this case, I would suggest that a close review of the court's order would suggest that the court really made no findings of credibility regarding conflicting material evidence in this case, which would be the very notion that you suggest that the trial court had the opportunity to, in fact, see and hear the witnesses. Yet this order, I would respectfully submit, is unusual in that respect because it recites narratives by both parties when dealing with suspicious circumstances, confidential relationships, etc. Yet in the case of conflicting evidence on material issues, never finds one way or the other. The court ultimately found
That is correct.
And that was about what I was to say, Your Honor. In that respect, it found that it was not shown by clear and convincing evidence. But with respect to finding that one version was more credible than another, I would suggest that we write this out.
Is that implied and defined?
Well, I would suggest that it is not implied, Your Honor. It implies nothing other than that it was not shown by clear and convincing evidence. And the court also expressed some confusion. I won't say confusion, but I would say the court found that it was unable to determine from case law in this state whether or not the use of the what I'll call the Henke criteria applied to inter vivos transactions. Subsequently, in the Klinger decision by this court, authored by Justice Castle, what was previously presumption was now determined to be an inference in a will contest case. I would also suggest that the trial court did in fact apply the Henke criteria to these inter vivos transfers, and I believe that he was correct in that respect. That's for this court to determine. I believe that the case that we have before us is a very factually intense case, and it's beyond my meager ability to stand here any time allowed to summarize all of the evidence in this case. However, I'd like to focus on a couple of things. So one of the most important criteria for the court to determine here is whether or not Carl Landgraf had independent advice of counsel. I think that the court found that there was evidence supporting a close and confidential relationship. I think that the court found that there was evidence supporting each and every one of the suspicious circumstances identified in the Henke line of cases, which then, whether it's an inference, whether it's a presumption in Ms. Eichel's case, there is some now burden shifting to the extent of showing that either it is not the result of undue influence or that there was independent advice of counsel. I think that in this case, the evidence is clear in establishing that undue influence and from the teaching of this court as well is a process, and it is a process that takes place over time.
In the will context, the statute is very clear that the burden of persuasion never shifts.
That is correct.
And I'm talking about the burden of production.
I agree.
So how does that framework translate to the interlibus context? Is there a shifting burden of persuasion under our system of law?
As I think you instructed in the Plinger case, it really is more a burden of production. And ultimately, we agree that the burden of proof lies for the plaintiffs.
So,
in this case, I don't believe this case. But I would like to make a point that Henry Price found in 1986 that the clear and convincing standard should apply in matters of this sort because they are equitable in nature. I think that there is reason for the court to re-examine that in this particular context, because as was also been stated by this court, whether these instruments were inter vivos or testamentary in nature, they were people didn't. And in this particular case, because undue influence is a process, it had reached a point where only a couple of years prior to Carl Landgraf's death, when he, in fact, was in declining physical and mental condition, which evidence was unrefuted, he entered into these transactions, which were not made known by constructive knowledge and filing until he went into a nursing home.
This claim was pursued only on the basis of undue influence. You did not challenge the competence of the vendor.
You're exactly right. We did not. But that didn't mean that the mental condition of Carl Landgraf was not highly relevant to the issue of undue influence
susceptibility.
That is correct. And one of the suspicious circumstances is an elderly person in reclining physical or mental condition. And in fact, in this case, Dr. Blum, whose opinions were unrefuted, and who's the author of one of the accepted models in forensic psychiatry, in fact adopted by the ABA Joint Commission on Aging, along with the American Psychological Association, found that from a medical standpoint, Carl Landgraf was the victim of undue influence. And in fact, that he had an impaired executive function, which made it very difficult for him to understand abstract concepts. I am running out of time, but I'd like to very briefly mention the fact that Carl Landgraf, for much of his life, did have advice in the form of Richard Koch. And because of what we contend to be faltering and susceptibility of Carl Landgraf, he was ultimately isolated without independent advice. When he entered into these transactions, he was taken to Humboldt, Nebraska, and met a person he had never met before. In less than an hour, there was only a discussion, not of the intended transactions, but an introductory session. When he returned later to that session, he was there with a write-up of questionable origin, which is a typewritten three-page document, which by the end of less than an hour ended up not being followed in the jury court. He came in with the majority of his estate to be subject to a sale, ultimately became a gift. And in that short session, the documents had not been prepared. The attorney who prepared those documents was not present when they were executed on two occasions. He had no idea what the motivation for Carl Landgraf was in making this
these transactions.
He had no history.
He had no history of the relationship between the defendant, who had, we believe, shown through the evidence, financially exploited on numerous occasions prior during Carlisle. He did not ever read the documents that the letter was prepared, and he did not have any information regarding the mental or physical condition so he was deprived of that. For those reasons, we would ask that the court exercise an exercise.
Yes.
De novo. Review the facts carefully, apply them to the law, and reverse the finding. Thank you very much.
Ms. Stoll, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, may it please the counsel. My name is Jeanette Stoll, and along with my co-counsel, Justin Hyde, I'm here on behalf of Gail and Marvin Gail, and I serve Lily Atwood in this case. In this case, the district court determined that the plaintiff failed to meet his burden of proving the existence of undue influence. In cases involving pre-death transfers of real estate, the party seeking to set aside the conveyance has to prove the existence of undue influence by clear and convincing evidence. Burden of proof has been and continues to be a key issue in this case. This court has uniformly held that the higher clear and convincing evidence standard of proof applies in these cases as opposed to the lower standard in will contest cases. Clear and convincing evidence means the amount of evidence which produces in the prior fact a firm conviction or belief that undue influence existed.
What is the best rationale to adhere to that?
If you're looking just at black letter case law, it's the difference between equity and a legal case. Honestly, my justification and my best reason why there should be a difference between those standards of proof is you have a deed that has been executed. In this case, a couple years before this litigation was brought, before Mr. Landgraf died. And people rely on that. The people who were gifted the land, the people who sold, who bought land, mortgage companies, bank companies who have invested in the land, have relied on it. And we don't want to be stripping away title to land years after the fact, unless we can show clear and convincing evidence, as this court has held in Price and numerous other occasions, that deeds do get extra special dignity of having that clear and convincing evidence standard of proof. And this court has never wavered from having that clear and convincing evidence standard apply in cases involving pre-death conveyances through deeds. And regardless of what can be a little bit confusing law about presumptions of undue influence and inferences of undue influence, and whether or not those apply the same to deed cases as they do to will contest cases, I can also see differences in the summary judgment context or what you're talking about in jury trial and jury instructions. But putting all of that aside, this court has uniformly held that the plaintiff bears the ultimate burden of proof throughout trial to prove the existence of undue influence. And again, in here in each case, that's clear and convincing evidence. The district court in this case held that the plaintiff failed to meet that high burden, and that decision should be affirmed by this court. When you're looking at undue influence, it's important to remember that undue influence has to be proven to have existed at the time that the deeds were executed. So the key time frame that we're talking about in this case is June 2011, when the deeds were executed. The key evidence regarding what happened in June 2011 came from three different witnesses. My client, Mr. Neumeister, but more importantly, Kelly Works, who was the attorney who was representing Mr. Landgraf at the time, and executed the documents, drafted the documents, and discussed these issues with Mr. Landgraf, as well as Lauren Radke, who was Mr. Works' assistant, who was there during the signing of those documents. Mr. Works testified at trial regarding the two different meetings that he had with Mr. Landgraf. During that first meeting, Mr. Landgraf appeared to be interviewing Mr. Works to make sure that he could trust him and move forward with his representation. During that meeting, Mr. Works saw absolutely no evidence that Mr. Landgraf was being influenced in any way, shape, or form.
Mr. Neumeister always present?
He was during he was present during these meetings. He was also present during meetings with prior attorneys. That's what Carl wanted. Carl always asked that Mr. Neumeister be present with meetings, including meetings back in 1999 with Richard Pope. So that was sort of their modus operandi, the way that they handled things. So yes, he was there, but there was ample evidence at trial from several different attorneys, in fact, including Mr. Works in June 2011, saying that Gail took a really passive role in these meetings. Carl was there, having the conversations, leading the conversations, telling Mr. Works what he wanted to do. Gail interjected occasionally, but did not lead the discussion in any way, shape, or form. During the second meeting, Carl came back to the second meeting with Mr. Works with notes about what he wanted done, because that's what Mr. Works had asked him to do. They talked through absolutely every point on those notes, discussed them. There was no evidence of any influence, no influence or interjection by Gail Neumeister. This was indeed what Carl wanted to have done, and Mr. Works testified about having gone over those notes point by point. There was a discussion about how this land was going to get transacted. Carl wanted to give one parcel to the Neumeisters outright as a gift and to sell the other parcels at a far reduced fair market value, well below fair market value. So the overall idea of this transaction was a needed gift, and he wanted to make sure that he had some amount of cash flow in order to pay his bills. So what Carl was really looking for was to have Gail Neumeister paid his bills in exchange for getting this land.
The agreement with opposing counsel's characterization that somehow was for sale more than $2 million.
The whole transaction morphed a little bit, but it was originally going to be a gift. Because the rest of the transaction that was supposed to be a sale was so far below fair market value that it was for all intents and purposes a gift. What Mr. Wirt suggested is instead, let's look at those overall numbers of what you were looking for your cash flow. Let's sell one parcel at full fair market value to reflect exactly what Carl came in wanting. Then the other ones we're going to give as a gift. That'll be easier for tax planning purposes. It'll be better for accounting purposes, but it's going to accomplish the exact same thing that Carl wanted to accomplish. And I think all of this morphing that the plaintiff wants to make look like influence in his change of mind was indeed rational reason. Carl sat down with his attorney, had a discussion, said, this is what I want to do. His attorney said to him, I don't think that's the best way to do it. Here is my suggestion. We can accomplish essentially what you want to accomplish, but doing it a little bit different way. Carl listens to that, like a rational client, says, yes, I think that's okay. Let's go ahead and do it. And then Kelly Wirtz prepares those documents as they agreed at the end of the meeting, sends them to Mr. Landgraf with a cover letter, giving him fair warning. These are big numbers. These are big decisions. You need to make sure that this is really what you want to do. Mr. Wirtz also warned Mr. Landgraf, once you sign these deeds, you don't have the chance to change your mind, so make sure you want to do this. And a handful of days later, Mr. Landgraf comes to Mr. Works' Nebraska City office on a Saturday morning when he's in town for a funeral already, signs the documents before Lord Radke. Yes, he was. And Ms. Radke, because he was taking Carl's meeting on that day, Ms. Radke testified about that interaction, said that Gail Neumeister hung back, sat down in the chair when they came into the office. Carl came to the front desk, handled his own business, understood what he was there for, and signed the documents in her presence. And we have all of this evidence of Lord Radke, Kelly Works, and Gail Neumeister, the only people who have any really relevant, direct, pointed evidence regarding the June 2011 timeframe, saying there was absolutely no shred of evidence of anything being done incorrectly or Gail Neumeister exercising any sort of undue influence. And then turning to a related issue around that. He is the attorney for Mr. Landgraf. He was chosen by Carl out of Columbus, admittedly, but he was chosen by Carl to be the attorney that he saw. Both Mr. Neumeister and Mr. Wirtz testified at trial that Mr. Wirtz, nobody in Mr. Wirtz's office had ever provided any sort of representation to Gail Neumeister or any of his family members prior to that. In fact, he testified that they did not even know each other. So Gail Neumeister was trying to unduly influence this transaction, and one of his ways of trying to accomplish that was to get him to a different attorney. He chose an attorney he didn't even know. So that certainly wasn't the motivation. In fact, it was Carl who chose that he wanted to go to see Kelly Wirtz because, as he told Kelly Wirtz, and Mr. Wirtz testified at trial, he thought all of the other Nebraska City attorneys were in cahoots with each other, and he wanted to go someplace else. So the evidence was ample at trial that Kelly Wirtz was an attorney who was chosen by Carl because he was disenchanted with some of his prior representation that he had gotten from some other attorneys in the past. Another key part of this 2011 time frame was testimony from Irene Piper. She was a neighbor of Carl's when she was back in town in between over-the-road trucking jobs. She befriended Carl by bringing him high and having conversations that honestly nobody else in this world ever had with Carl. Over a course of 3-4 years from 2008 to late 2011, after these documents were executed, Ms. Piper had many conversations with Carl, expressing his desire to give his farmers, including Mr. Neumeister, his farms. And the plan that Ms. Piper testified to at trial is exactly the plan that Kelly Wirtz drafted and Carl Landgraf executed in 2011, showing this was indeed his plan and purpose, not his. For those reasons, we ask
that
you affirm the district court's
decision.
Thank you very much.
We have time for about He is over. The court is adjourned, and you are excused.
Thank you.